PGCert Addictions course, and I really enjoyed that. And I have to admit, I was really stumped at times trying to follow what you were putting across. However, for my own sake, to understand the I and the me, did you choose those not from like a psychological theory, but from just grammar? The me as in something happening
now,
to
if
the
if you
I?
Look at George Herbert Mead's work,
right,
on mind, self and society, Mead makes a distinction of I and me,
right,
in his work on the self. Now, what I find interesting, this shows how we all go around in cycles. Mm-hmm. I wrote my first book on learning in 1987, Adult Learning in the Social Context. I used Mead totally, and never once did I see the distinction between I and me. But when I went back, you know, 15 or so years later, it hit me in the face.
Okay.
You see? So I built it up on this sort of social psychological idea. But I saw, but Tomasello also gave me the clue, you see, because Tomasello, when he talked about imitation, said, it's like Mead's me, you see. So it was reading Tomasello, it was going back to Mead, it was thinking, well, if I actually do move the thinking to the side and put the doing in there, I get a totally different picture.
Thank you very much, Peter. That was a fascinating presentation. I love it when people take things apart like that and make you rethink them from the base up. Just one question. I'm kind of struggling to see how into your model there affects the whole issue of power. I find myself asking about that quite a lot. For example, there's lots of different types of learning there and ways of learning it. And, I mean, there's a famous quote by a South American, Eduardo Galeano, that says, some of the worst educated people I have ever met can read, write, and have university PhDs. Because, you know, why are we doing all this learning? What is it for? So I find myself asking things about how does that relate to, you know, the ability of certain groups in society to dominate discourse and truths? And maybe a lot of what people are learning by whichever aspect of the model isn't actually the truth and is could be quite damaging. I'm thinking at the moment, most of the people here are learning that all these public service cuts are inevitable. It has been systematically churned out week after week after week to the extent that people have seemed to have more or less accepted it. And I think that's a highly disputable piece of learning that most of us are absorbing. So I'm just wondering how the issue of power, social justice, what some people might have called really useful knowledge.
Yeah, so if I then go back to my model of learning and put thinking in the middle and not doing, right, then very clearly the thinking element in us, using your point, is to what extent do we learn to be critical or even analytical of the situations? So when it doesn't involve the doing, I've got this other side to my learning model, right? And then thinking becomes at the heart. And then the thinking could drive the doing. So we are such complex human beings that, you know, I'm not sure which comes at the heart of it. Is it emotion? Is it cognition? Or is it action? And the question you're asking me is saying, yeah, if I'd have put the cognition at the heart, then I've got the whole issues of reason, of criticality, of response to power, in the sense of seeing indoctrination. Because, you see, in one of my books, I actually suggested the learning society is an indoctrinational society, that we are actually learning because we're being indoctrinated. And let's think of advertising every day, for instance. We are indoctrinated. Since my grandchildren only live 100 yards from me, I watch a hell of a lot of children's television. And I suddenly realise, 8 minutes an hour, they are being indoctrinated, not to buy, but to want. And the consumer society is built upon this whole thing that who has the power to spend the money to indoctrinate? And we've watched government do just the same in this last 6 months. And very few people have sort of said, you know, Well, the Labour Party tried and they lost the election, but that was another matter. But the whole point is there are alternative ways. We all know that. But in fact, as Mrs. Thatcher said, there is no other way. And that's the picture with which we are presented, and most people believe it. Because, in fact, most people from their childhood have been taught that learning is responding to what you're told. So I want to go back to childhood learning again. This is why I think adult learning as such is wrong. All of these issues of learning lie in childhood learning. And what we've got to really do as adult educators is to understand the whole of the learning process and see, yes, we're fitting into a pattern with which we learned as small kids. It hasn't changed. And so to talk about adult learning as opposed to childhood learning is a fallacy. Learning is learning is learning is learning. It's just I bring different experiences at different times or I'm in different situations. It's still the same process or set of processes. But it's all the processes, and this is where the problem comes in, is I now want to equate learning with conscious living. And I want to see the I as the life force that pushes. And so I think in learning theory, we've got to get back to these fundamentals. And then you can see where we come into that. The me is the recipient of all these. Yeah? It's only when the I takes over, like he did with some of the students yesterday. I'm not going to say any more.
Pamela Clayton. I wanted to ask a few things along the way, but I was being imitative. Nobody was saying anything, so I thought I'd just follow the crowd. You know? And then Jim, of course, broke the duck, so I spoke. That's not what I want to say now, but it was interesting, actually, that. No, I want to come back to the I and the me, and it's not unrelated to what Liam was saying. It seems to me that I'm thinking of students of mine, particularly Open University students, in their first course, who are from working-class backgrounds, never thought they would ever come to university, can't quite believe they have. So that's my, if you like, my what I'm thinking about. But I'm thinking about other kinds of people as well, in situations where they have no power. And I'm not thinking here about the content of the learning, whether it is really useful knowledge or even total lies. No, I'm thinking about the difficulty for some people of getting away from the just me, or even or having an I. Yeah. Seems to me to be a form of freedom, which is wonderful, but not always the case.
Yeah, remember in Women's Ways of Knowing, that very first group of women, the silents, they've got no I. None at all. They were total me's. And they'd lost the power of the I. And I think in one way that's one of the most insightful chapters in that book. Is the loss of the I in a whole group of women. But it's not just women, as you know. You see, I mean, I heard this group lecture in the States when soon after the book came out, and they said, while we interviewed 135 women, we think we'd have got similar results if we'd interviewed 135 men. And I think they're right, because you will have done, as I have, and most of us who are adult educators who've been out in the sticks, have found so many people. Then I look at me, right? I mean, I left school without any A-levels. I failed them all, everything. I joined the Air Force as a regular because I had no other job to do. I had no I, in a sense. I had no confidence that I was anything more than just a working-class kid who'd flopped at school and I had to find... And it was only when I discovered the I... as it were, when somebody told me I was a bloody fool, and I said, no, I'm not. But suddenly, and that, in a sense, sparked something off. Now, I think it's the discovery of the I that is so important. And I mean, I taught foundation students with the OU for many years as well, so I saw this with, and I think... I try to say to I tell people all around the world, for I was a working class dropout from school, because in so many countries in the world, if you failed at the school, you know, so in China or in Singapore, I say, well, I dropped out of school, I was a failure. I say, but I don't think I'm really so unintelligent, you see. I say, how many people in your country are the same as me? And I think that's the whole issue, it's the discovery of the I, which is important.
It's Anne Campbell, I'm from the OU in Scotland. And I'm here actually as part of the learning development team, although I work with students as well. But what I actually do is I run online courses for staff. And I was very interested in, you know, your discussion point about the conscious adaptation and when that becomes learning. Because what I was thinking about as a practitioner, as somebody who is trying to get adults to learn new ways of doing things, in this case they're teaching and learning and encouraging their students, is how to incorporate that kind of idea, this unconscious adaptation, within our training courses, so that people can actually learn, perhaps not consciously, but they can pick things up kind of as they go along.
I almost think we've got to come back to this issue of reflection at the end of the day, to get people to reflect on specific experiences. Even, you know, to say, you know, well, what do you think you have learned without being aware of it, as it were? Bringing this to conscious level is very hard. And that's what, you know, my Hungarian friend said, you know, it's mining one jewel at a time, because we find it very hard to reflect on this. And I think part of it is because we spend so much of our learning thinking about cognition and not about doing. And if we can get people to think more about doing, I think we could actually bring more to the conscious surface. That's what I think now. And as I think more about this, and I think it is the doing which is important. Because, you know, we do live in our acts. You know, Husserl said, I live in my acts. Well, it's I live in my acts. So action becomes so important to me. And perhaps that's the only way we can get into conscious mind, talking about what they did, not what they thought.
I think I'll just add a comment there, actually, because I'll come back to you back there, Margaret. I've been reflecting myself, and it relates to the question you asked about the nature of modern society and the learning that exists in modern society around empirical knowledge v. practical knowledge and learning through doing. I think we live much more in a society where it's about learning through doing, through experimentation. A lot of people now talk about new digital divides coming about. Not the digital divide between poorer people and richer people, but the digital divide between younger people and older people. The confidence that younger people have through learning through experimentation. And certainly in the context, not so much of staff development, but a lot of the work that I'm doing, working with other professionals and trying to encourage those professionals to communicate in different ways, to use so-called Web 2 technologies, where there's enormous resistance because I think partly the fear of experimentation, the fear of revealing that they cannot do something, I'm here talking about professors and people at that level, and them not being able to do things that a 12-year-old would do. That's a very interesting modern phenomenon.
This is why, Mike, I think we've got in our thinking about learning to go back to childhood learning. I don't think we should draw the separation. Because children, because they don't have status problems in the same way, they do experiment more, they do things by trial and error more, they do ask more questions, as long as they're allowed to. Mm. And it's the I then that becomes important, because it's they who are doing it. My 7-year-old grandson, he probably knows more about the computer than I do. You know, he comes down, he comes and sits at my computer and turns it on and gets on with it. And I watch him.
I'm Margaret Sutherland. I work here in the School of Education. I was really interested in your reference to Sternberg's work.
Yeah.
I know that work quite well, and he's done some recent thinking on wisdom and so on as well.
Yeah. I've cited that in the next editorial, the International Journal of Lifelong Learning.
But the example you gave of practical intelligence was people always saying the right thing, and you kind of, I think, suggested that because of that, they had got on, whatever we might define got on as. And I wonder, do you think some people have got on, not so much because they said the right thing, but because they didn't want to rock the boat, they've acquiesced, they've ingratiated themselves, they've conformed, therefore got on.
Yeah,
and I suppose my next final bit of question would be, and I think that is about self, self-interest, self, et cetera. So where in all of this is the us and the we?
Sorry, the
us and we collective alongside the self and I.
Yeah. Now, I think that's a very, very good question. But, I mean, do you remember White's study Organisational Man? Yeah. Now, what he brought out was the fact the organisational person is the one who doesn't rock the boat. They weren't looking for first-class honours. They were looking for 2-2s because they were the people who would fit in and wouldn't rock the boat. So there is that other side. There's those who play the game in the way that Sternberg sort of is, and there are the others who even they're frightened to rock the boat. You know, they're just very good at fitting in. And you know, this is part of the complexity, I think. This is why I want, in my own work, I want to get learning away from something which is special. I want to get, learning is about living in all its diversity and all its complexity. And then I'm not sure I know what learning is. You know, I've only just really sort of reached this feeling that the I is the life force. Without, I had to break away from Freud in a sense, you know what I mean? So it's just not the I is the very force that keeps me alive. Once I lose the I, you can forget me. And so the I me, I had to go back, you know, to George Herbert Mead rather than to Freud and sort of say, yeah, I can accept this. This makes more sense to me. So, yeah, I am playing my part, but very frequently I keeps quiet and me plays its part or doesn't play its part. And so I want to, the book I'm writing now is going to be called Proactive and Reactive Learning because it is tying to, it's asked the philosophical questions about this. But this is early days yet, you know. I've only been sort of playing with this seminar for a few weeks.
Hey, Jim Bradley from University of Stirling. Peter, could you just expand on the difference that you highlighted between practitioner research and action research?
Yep.
Neither of which, of course, is as valued as much as other research within the research community.
Yeah. Basically, many of the students I was supervising for their doctorates, and many of the people I worked with, they weren't interested in changing anything. They were interested in understanding it. And many of the people's PhDs were, in fact, going to become reports for their managers. This is what we're doing. They weren't going to make recommendations anyway at all. They were just trying to highlight this. And they were doing it in their own practice situation. And so I read a lot of PhDs where there was no intention to change. There was just an intention to understand. Just so that managers, whether it became a report, could sit back and say, yeah, this is how they see what's going on. No more than that. But then, if I'm a Marxist, say, and I come into this, God, I want to change it. And so a lot of action researchers come in with their own ideology. It may be Marxist, or it may be a conservative ideology, that's irrelevant. But they come in with an ideology that says, I've got to find out why it's not working so I can put it right, you see. So I think the difference is, and the difference when I wrote Practitioner Researcher, I tried to make was a simple one really, is that most of the people who are not, as it were, ideologically tied up with the research they're doing actually turn out to be practitioner researchers. But those who actually are, for one reason or another, have an ideology, usually their research is not an end product of understanding. Their research is an end product of change. And that was the difference.
Any last questions?
Leon Robinson, working religious education in the school.
Oh, careful, careful.
Dear me. I don't know how
the
to
good
fit
Lord,
in.
The good Lord's intervened since then.
Oh, no, I'll try and say the right thing here. This is almost unconnected to everybody else's question, but it's been a constant challenge for me in religious education when I've been wanting to have my initial teacher education students take responsibility and really get active and do things. But the real problem comes when we start asking questions about what it means to do anything in religious education, because you can't do religion. You can be religious, but having religious understanding, understanding things from a religious perspective, or understanding others' religious perspectives, seldom, if ever, involves any doing. And I would welcome any light you could shed on that.
Yeah, I think, I mean, if I said to you, when I was 7 years and a lecturer in religious education, and I was in Dudley in the West Midlands, which was quite an interesting place, actually, to teach religious education. But I agree with you. The fundamental trouble is, well, I say the fundamental is not, it's massive numbers of trouble. But I actually did my master's degree on the level of conceptual knowledge necessary to understand biblical stories. And I tested teachers in the whole of an LEA. And I got a negative average. They didn't understand the conceptual level necessary to teach. But I think, in one sense, on the conceptual level, we've got to do a Bultmann and demythologize to get youngsters to really understand. Then the doing, I suppose, yeah, I mean, we've all done things like, you know, visiting the local mosque and the local temple. And in a sense, they die after one or two visits. Because they're not involved, they're not engaged. And I think you know, it's a phenomenally difficult job teaching at RE because, you know, what we get landed with are teaching biblical stories that don't fit, are total rubbish, you know? I hope I'm not offending you by saying that, but I am ordained, remember? So, but you see, it's true, I have this. My seven-year-old grandson brought a reading book home this week. It was about Noah. And it read as if it was a fact. And we actually had to say to him, now, Liam, remember, you've just read about myths. So we had to re-educate him, you know, at this level. So I think that we don't do a very good job conceptually. And because we don't do a very good job conceptually, I think the other side of it, the practice, is do we actually use multiculturalism in schools properly? Do we actually have parents come to, you know, do we have Islam parents come in to teach, you know, to talk about their beliefs, you know, to the class in the same way? And I think this is where it comes in. If little Ahmed's mother comes in and says, well, in our, you know, in our mosque, and we do this, that, or the other. And this is what. Now, at a certain age, I think using multiculturalism in that way, but it's still cognitive. And I myself, I've been playing with the whole business of meaning and meaning making. And that takes me back again to the exploration and experimentation. And I've actually come to the question that the thing that makes me as a human being different from a dolphin, which is a very, very intelligent animal, is that I have a quest, a meaning quest, and the dolphin doesn't have, as far as I know. And I have to say as far as I know, because we don't know enough about the language of dolphins. And so at the moment, I think I want to go back to the asking the fundamental questions in exploration and experimentation, and say, religion comes out of this too, or at least spirituality comes out of this too. and religious systems come out of it because they're answers to the same sets of questions. But it's taken hundreds and hundreds of years. But I think that we're so caught up with faith and what the church says. This is why the church doesn't like me. But basically because now they wrote a profile on my work in the church I'm a member of, and they concluded that he's a good pastor, but he's a better social scientist.
Any more? Ah, Jim again.
Sorry, it's Jim Bradley again from the University of Stirling still. I just thought I'd mention that things are rapidly changing. I'm fascinated by this because as a practitioner, this really interests me. And I have to apologise because I'm kind of developing this question as I'm talking and I know what I want to say. I'm just trying to formalise it. But in a community where a lot of the theory is abstract and unattached to practice, what brought you to this idea of developing a theory from practice?
Writing the practitioner researcher, in a sense, because that was a funny book to write, and there's a lot of funny stories about it, because I went across to America, this is a Josie Bass book, and whilst I was on the plane, I was sort of thinking about the idea of theory and practice, and sort of practice preceding theory. And then, you know, as you do when you're jet-lagged, you don't get sleep. So I sat up that night and I wrote a book proposal, which I gave Josie Bass in the morning and I accepted in the afternoon, so it wasn't bad. and I wrote that book in about 8 weeks, 10 weeks in the evenings, get it out my system. But it was the fact that there's no conceptual relationship between knowing and doing, and being able. And then I realised when I was writing practitioner researcher that for most of us, our practice did precede our theory. And then I went back to Argyris and Sean and found this note again. And I thought, no, I'm not sure. They've made an assumption that I've still got an espoused theory. And I'm not sure that I have. So where did it start from? Well, by that time I was realising the Enlightenment was wrong. That basically... we'd made an awful lot of mistakes. And one of them, in fact, was the idea of rational theory coming first. So, you know, that's where it came from. And so for the last 10 years, you know, I've been trying to teach people that Enlightenment wasn't, in fact, that good thing I learned about in school. But, in fact, it was the thing that mucked us up.
One final question, if anybody has one, in which case I think we'll bring proceedings to an end with a comment I'll make to my colleagues here. Research Enhancement Framework, 4 books, 32 weeks.
Well, come on, Mike, let's do it.
Well, once again, let me thank Peter for this afternoon and all the great energy that he's put into responding to your questions and a very entertaining and informative seminar. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you very much, Elisa. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.